All right, we are continuing our study in Joshua. Interesting thing about this conquest is that how it's played out. I don't know why, but I mean, it's just how it does. When you talk about the conquest, we talked about last week, we talked about the southern conquest. All right, this week, we're talking about the northern conquest. We're going to be in chapter 11. I kind of got two maps up here, but this one is kind of like the one that we first started with. And you can see where they start. Well, I don't even know. They start over here in Shittim, okay? And they cross the Red Sea, the Jordan River. Yeah. They cross the Jordan River. They would then attack Jericho and then, of course, go up to Ai and then Bethel. This is the central campaign. They go straight across. And then, of course, later on for the southern campaign, they come down. And then they go all the way back up for the northern campaign. Okay, they actually stop after the southern campaign in verse 43 of chapter 10. It says, then Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp of Gilgal. And I don't know how it is that way. It's just like a cross, you know, straight across and then from down to up. Okay. I only bring that up because there are some speculations. Just kind of be aware of it. It's just God trying. So one speculation I found interesting, I don't know if it's really true or not, but kind of like how when you go to Numbers and you start looking at how the tribes were arranged in the camp during their wandering years, you can actually see like their camp making a cross. So if you were like to see from high up, maybe an aerial view of the camp, you would see symbolism of a cross. Some people try to make this out to be like that. I don't have any idea. I did find it interesting thought to think about, but I can't claim that. Can't prove that. But nonetheless, so they're back in Gilgal, and we notice that the progression of these campaigns tend to get a little harder and harder. Not for the children of Israel, so to speak, but the enemies, they get bigger and bigger. Okay, you know, you had Jericho, the walls came down. You went to Ai, they messed up there, but they eventually prevailed. Right, and then when you get to the southern campaign, five of these kings show up and they decide, you know, well, the king of Jerusalem, mind you, he comes up and he says, I'm going to grab all these other kings and I'm going to get us together and we're going to fight against the children of Israel. Well, more specifically, they actually go back to Gibeon. Gibeon's not on this map. I don't know why I don't have it on there. But Gibeon, they go back to Gibeon because Gibeon made a covenant relationship with the children of Israel. And so they're going to try to take Gibeon back. Israel comes and saves the day from their destruction. So instead of just like one city at a time, now it's multiple kings or multiple cities. When we get to this northern campaign, though, it's everybody in the northern kingdom. It's not just a few kings. It's almost all of them come out to meet Israel. And so we see they come up, and as we read, this area here, which is Sea of Galilee area, becomes where they start their campaign, where they start their fighting. Throughout this lesson, I want to make it clear, and I'm going to kind of emphasize on this a little bit throughout. This is just as much important for you today as it was for them. Because this is the end of the conquest, or at least for what we have in Joshua, for the fighting and stuff like that. After this conquest is over, Israelites take control. But this is very, very important for you, just like it was for them. So let's let's start up chapter 11, beginning with verse 1. And we're going to read down to verse 5. It says, "And it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, to the king of Shimron, to the king of Akishah, and to the kings who were from the north, in the mountains, in the plain south of Chinoroth, in the lowland, in the heights of Doron on the west, to the Canaanites in the east and in the west, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, and the Jebusite, in the mountains, and the Hivite below Hermon in the land of Mizpah. So they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude, with very many horses and chariots. And when all these kings had met together, they came and camped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel." Let's stop there for a minute. It says this army is like the people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude. This is going to be the largest army that Israel has ever faced. I don't know, I mean, most of y'all have probably been to a beach, but you know as well as I do that trying to count the sand grains would take years. I can't tell you exactly how many of these soldiers are, but I know that it's enough to engulf the few hundred thousand people that would be fighting on Israel's side. As a nerd, I want to bring out that this is kind of your leveling up period. You start off with a small boss and then or a small enemy, and then the enemies just get bigger and bigger and bigger. I know I'm showing my nerd there, but that's kind of the best way I can describe this, is that Israel has gotten to a point where instead of just going to a few, now it's like this is it. This is going to be the wars that end all wars kind of deal for them. Who is the one person that has been fighting on Israel's behalf through all of this? God, the Lord. He has been fighting against all of these individuals. Last time we saw how he sent down hailstones and like picked them off one by one. More enemies were killed by the hailstorm than by the sword of the Israelites. He makes the sun stop so that they don't run out of daylight to finish the job. We saw how he defeated Jericho and Ai. The walls fell. All this time, God is doing the work. I think we as Christians find this, again, we talk about this in Bible class, we kind of get agnostic when it comes to what God is doing. But we see that God does these things in the hardest of times. Is it really so hard for us to imagine Him doing things like this now? I mean, we may not see Him do those things, but we do know that He does those things. And so again, I want to emphasize how important this is for us as it was for them. So led by the Jabin king of Hazor, we're going to read that he gets destroyed. Hazor gets destroyed. He dies. You're actually going to find, if you go over to Judges, that like 400 years later, or not 400 years, but sometime later, the city gets rebuilt and another guy named Jabin, the king of Hazor, tries to take over. I don't want us to confuse that. It's a different person. Maybe the same name, a namesake, family member, something like that, but it's not the same person. It's the largest northern city in northern Canaan. Over a dozen kings unite. Only other king named is Jobab, the king of Madon. Why? We looked at the king names of the kings in the last campaign. This king, you got the major king over all of them, and then you got like a secondary king. But the rest of the kings are not even named. They're not even mentioned. They're not important. Reason being is because it's not about who necessarily is the king. It's about the immense amount of confrontation, obstacle, how big and massive this army is going up against Israel. That's the point. The point is that it's the army and how massive this army is. Camped at the waters of Meriam, I mentioned that. Of course, again, this is important because this is Galilee area. So you kind of get this visual. If you remember your lessons in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you know, Jesus spent a lot of time around there. We get to verse 6. It says, "But the Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire.' So Joshua and all the people of war with him came against them suddenly by the waters of Meriam, and they attacked them. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and chased them to the greater Sidon, to the brook Mesphroth," and I apologize if I'm butchering these names, ladies and gentlemen, "and to the valley of Mizpah, eastward. They attacked them until they left none of them remaining. So Joshua did to them as the Lord had told them. He hamstringed their horses and burned their chariots with fire." One of, again, I'm going to emphasize this a lot, okay? I hope everybody's paying attention. What does God do when Joshua is faced with this immense, massive amount of an army? He encourages him. He says, "Do not be afraid because of them." I know that there is at least like 300 times just in the Old Testament alone that you can read about God telling somebody not to fear. There's plenty of times in the New Testament. Understanding that this fear that you would have looking at a massive army like that, I mean, I can understand it. But I want to take a moment to look at the fact that the children of Israel going up against these people, that's an immense amount of faith. It's like you sitting in a chair. Okay, we've talked about this before probably, or I know I have. You probably heard this before. What is faith? It's being able to say to this pew, "I know this pew is going to hold me up. If I sit down on that pew, I know this pew will hold me up." The problem that most people have when that type of faith is that they never sit in the chair. They never see anyone sit in the chair. They've never sat in the chair or in the pew. But they believe that the pew would hold them up. These are a group of people that have listened to Joshua, have listened to Moses, have listened to God. They have dealt with all these other armies, these other cities. God has delivered them into their hand. And the moment that they see this massive army that is the size of a beach, Canada's the sand, the multitudes of the sand, they don't waver. And God encourages them and says, I've given you to them. I've given them to you. That's faith. And they still go fighting. They don't run and hide and cower. They still go out and fight. God is in control all the time. Even though we don't see him sometimes, we don't see the effects he does right off the bat. God is in control all the time. And this is an immense amount of faith that I think we ourselves have a tendency to discredit or not even acknowledge, because we ourselves, even in our own day and age, we don't always see what God is doing behind the scenes. But we need to be willing to sit in the pew, especially when it's necessary. This also can be seen as prophetic. A lot of people like to take this and look at it in prophecy. It makes me think of Psalm 2, though. And of course, in that same concept that's of prophecy, if you turn over to Psalm 2 with me real quick, we read, beginning with verse 1, it says, "Why do the nations rage and the people not a vain thing, a plot a vain thing? And the kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, 'Let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us.'" You can read this and look at Jesus. Absolutely. Look at the future of David, looking to the future. But you can also see this as this. Of all those times that the nations tried to raise against Israel, who was the victor? God is ultimately the victor, isn't he? And it's, we talked about that with Joel. Even though they may have gone through some issues, they may have been punished for some of the things they did, what was going to happen to the enemies of the nation? They were going to get what they were going to get the, what they deserved as well. And so Joshua and the army charge into battle. Canaanite confederation under Jabin retreats and is cut to pieces as they flee the battle. They get scared. When you see that, it's literally they have become scared. I can only say that's God. If you've got a massive army and you're looking at a small one, you would think to yourselves, we got this. This is going to end quick. We'll take them out in a few hours. But they get scared and they run off. As far as when it comes to the horses and the chariots, I put it on here, Deuteronomy 17, 16. And the whole idea was is that they cut the hamstrings of these horses. Some people would think, well, man, they can take them and use them for themselves. And they probably did, but not for war. They probably could be used, even though their hamstrings are cut. They might be able to use them for like beasts of burdens, like a pull a plow, but they're not going to be able to run into to war. But we do see over here in Psalm 20 and verse 7 that any time that the soldiers of Israel or the men of Israel would go to war, they would never ever go into something, into a battle with all of this. Now, they tried to do it later on in their history, but this right here, these chariots, would be the equivalent to us to what we would know as tanks. They're guarded on each side of them. Just imagine yourself, you've seen tanks before. If thousands of tanks were coming at you, that'd be like what the Israelites were thinking when these chariots were coming. But yet, Psalm 20 verse 7, David says, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. It didn't matter what their weaponry was. It didn't matter how hard or how immense they were, how big this army was. God had the victory. I rambled on a little bit. We're going to try to pick things back up. Verse 10. Joshua turned back at the time and took Hazor and struck its king with a sword, for Hazor was formerly the head of all those kingdoms. And they struck all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was none left breathing. Then he burned Hazor with fire. So all the cities of those kings and all their kings Joshua took and struck with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed them, as Moses the servant of the Lord had commanded. But as for the cities that stood on their mounds, Israel burned none of them except Hazor only, which Joshua burned. And all the spoil of these cities and the livestock, the children of Israel took a booty for themselves, but they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. And they left none breathing, as the Lord had commanded Moses his servant, as Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord has commanded Moses. So all of these are devoted to destruction. Hazor is the only one burned. Archaeology actually confirms this. It was burned, and then they tried to rebuild it, and they can still find remnants of this. Other cities not burned because God gave them for Israel to live in. If you go to Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 10, God tells them that they're going to live in cities that they have never built. Israel allowed to take the spoil, which is common. They were going to live in that time until they were able to produce food for themselves. But they were going to get it from everybody else. Josh left nothing undone. Did everything God commanded. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded him. where it says here in verse 15, as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. Notice how it says that. God commanded Moses, Moses commanded Joshua, Joshua did. What is that? God commanded Moses. Moses wrote it down. You know, when they were reviewing the law a few chapters before. Joshua is not consulting Moses at this time. Moses has been dead. Who is he consulting? The words of God. What Moses wrote down. He has the law. He has the Torah. Every bit of it. And so Joshua is following God's commandments by following Moses. That's just important for us today because many people want to hear God, but they're not willing to listen. You go to 1 Corinthians 11:1, what does it say? Paul writes, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." We understand that when we read the New Testament, especially like things that are written by Paul and Peter, that we know that that is in fact God's word. And it's important for us to read, study, and trust in it and imitate Paul as he imitates Christ. You see the same thing in the New Testament as you do in the Old. The word of God is how we get this information. It's how we know without a shadow of a doubt that what we're doing is according to God's will. When you get down to verse 16 through the 23, through verse 23, the last of this chapter, it says this: "Thus Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, and the land of Goshen, the lowland of the Jordan plain, the mountains of Israel and its lowlands, from Mount Halak and the ascent to Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon." Excuse me. "He captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All the others they took in battle. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them and that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them as the Lord had commanded Moses. And at the time Joshua came and cut off the Anakim from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, from all the mountains of Judah, and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. None of the Anakim were left in the land of the children of Israel. They remained only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had said to Moses, and Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Then the land rested from war." So they take the land as promised. Overwhelming control. They have taken it. Even though they don't take some of these villages, they take the major cities. Those places, they're going to live there. Okay, but it also means that there are some of these individuals that gets left out. If you wonder why they didn't go in and they didn't take them out, again, I cannot stress how and emphasize how important this is for you as it is for them. When you go, actually, not completely eradicated all Canaanites in the city. If you go over to chapter 13, beginning verse 1, it says, "Now Joshua was old, advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, 'You are old, advanced in years, and there remains very much land yet to be possessed.'" Why didn't they take all of it? Were they expecting God to do everything? Probably. This is one lesson that I want to make clear to every single Christian today. God is not going to remove obstacles. Not all of them. A lot of people will like to say that God will not give you more than what you can handle. I think that's confusing. When you actually read 1 Corinthians 10:13, what you actually read is God will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you can bear. A lot of people kind of mess that up a bit. What I will say is this, is that God will indeed give you things that you cannot bear. Children of Israel could not have taken on that entire massive army. Who did it? God. If God gives you something beyond what you think, beyond what you can bear, that means God is doing something. God is actually doing something behind the scenes. That doesn't mean that He's left you or forsaken you. That means He is dealing with it. And you need to rely on Him. That's the reason why He allows some bad things to happen. That's why He turns around and allows you to have things beyond what you can bear, so that you can trust Him. That you will rely on Him. That you will lean on Him. However, as I quoted 1 Corinthians 10:13, He won't allow you to be tempted beyond what you can bear. When you go to Judges chapter 2, verse 20 and 23, you actually see God is allowing those people to stay there to test the children of Israel. Are they going to continue doing what God told them to do or not? Are they going to make the right decisions or not? Because you know, if you remember our study in the Old Testament laws, they weren't supposed to intermarry with anyone outside their own, outside the Jews. They do end up doing that though. They intermarry with other tribes, other nations. They're going against God's will by doing that. You have a choice to do God's will or not. But He's not going to allow you to be tempted beyond what you can bear. He's not going to say it's going to be too hard for you not to resist to sin. So when you find yourselves in those hardships and you think you can't take it, believe me when I say God is actually doing something. You may not see it, but He is. And when you are faced with a choice to sin or not, to do good or to do bad, it's not going to be beyond your choice, beyond your free will to choose. And God is literally giving them the chance and opportunity to continue in doing what God had told them. And then, of course, you know, then we get into Joshua gives tribal allotments. And so this land starts to be given as it's been promised. Chapter 12, we're not going to read all of it, but it's broken down into the kings conquered by Moses and Joshua. So you have two kings east of the Jordan River, which land is given for about 2.5 of the tribes. And then you have, down to verse 7 through 24, 31 kings by Joshua and the children of Israel on the west of the Jordan River, and the land for about 9.5 tribes. God's fulfilling His promise here. This is basically just a record of what it is that has been taking place in the conquests. And so now that this record has taken place, it kind of picks up to how the rest of the remaining land will be conquered a little bit here and there. And then, of course, how the tribes will be given their allotted land. I am going to just stop here for that because, again, chapter 12 is not a really in-depth chapter. It's just more of a record. But I am going to go ahead and give us a conclusion. Again, I emphasize this is just as important for you as it is for them. I said this in Bible class that a lot of times people get agnostic about God, even Christians, where they see all of these things, they can trust that it happened, but they don't trust God to handle the small problems that we have today. They don't seem to think that God is actually overlooking all of this. It's like He came here in 0 to 33 AD, Jesus did, and then after that, it's just whenever until He comes again. That's not how it works. God's promises are sure. God will always keep them, but He's not going to take away the obstacles. He's not always going to take away the obstacles. What He will do is He'll make it to where He deals with most of the obstacle and you may deal with a small amount. We read in James chapter 1, "Count it all joy when you come into various trials and tribulations, for it produces peace," or patience, excuse me. Even when you read Acts chapter 5, you get where the disciples were being persecuted for his namesake. When they leave, after being done so, they magnified God. They glorified him. They praised him for being counted worthy to do that. We need to be acknowledged that even though we go through hardships, God's got this. So do not harden your heart against God and his people. This is a lesson that some of us stubborn people need to learn. And I would count myself among me at times. Again, it all boils down to faith, though. When you see that massive mountain, you may not be able to get it taken away. It may not be destroyed. It may not be moved. But you'll have the strength by God to actually climb it, or go around it, or go through it. The Song of Invitation is 294. Jesus is calling, 294. Again, I hope these lessons, I know it's Joshua. We like to look at his military campaign and things like that. But I hope these are encouraging to you, because you're just as much a soldier of Christ as Joshua is a general in Israel. Song 294. Let's stand and sing.
Jesus is tender.